Five, four, three, two, one.
I know you're gonna dig this.
Welcome to the Barrett Sports Media Podcast.
Think we could listen to the radio or something?
Radio? Who needs a radio?
Featuring the biggest names and newsmakers from the world of sports media.
Don't act like you're not impressed.
Now, here's your host, the president of Barrett Sports Media, Jason Barrett.
So you thought after a month of arrests involving a number of sports media personalities that the news cycle might slow down a bit, right? Well, in the words of Lee Corso, not so fast, my friend. Welcome in, everyone. I'm Jason Barrett. This is the Barrett Sports Media Podcast, episode number 9 of season 2. And boy, was last week a crazy one. The Jemele Hill ESPN saga had the entire nation talking. I'm going to share a few thoughts on that as part of today's 5 and 5. That's coming up in just a little bit. My guest this week is former radio executive turned senior advisor and play-by-play announcer Dan Mason. I had the pleasure of spending 40 quality minutes with Dan discussing a number of key areas of the radio business, and I'm excited to bring you that conversation a little later in the episode. Before I dive into the 5 and 5, I want to encourage you guys to check out some of the guest columns being produced on sportsradiopd.com. The work done so far by Dave Green, Brian Noe, Kevin Sheritz, Tyler McComas, and Dimitri Ravanos has been excellent. I think it's worth a few minutes of your time. Brandon Contis has been providing sports television news, and I'm working on a few other editions as well. I've had a lot of interest, which is great. I really appreciate it. Just know I can't bring everyone on board who inquires, but I'm constantly looking for content on different aspects of our business that might not be offered on the website right now. So if you have a unique idea or you work in a department that you feel others in the radio business would have an interest in learning more about, pass along the suggestion, and when time allows, I'll take a look at it. All right, but there's much to discuss this week. I don't want to keep you waiting, and actually, it's going to require an extra 60 seconds. I know, I'm breaking the rules. Don't get used to it, but for this one particular time, I'm going to give you a 5 and 6. So 5 stories, 6 minutes. Let's go.
There are 5 minutes remaining.
When Donald Trump puts your company on blast, that's not good for business. We could debate whether he should waste a second of his time worrying about ESPN, but when Jemele Hill called the leader of the country a white supremacist, you knew a response would follow.
I think that's one of the more outrageous comments that anyone could make, and certainly something that I think is a fireable offense by ESPN.
I wrote about the situation, and most who reached out agreed that ESPN's inconsistency with handling these situations is what put them in a negative spot in the first place. I said, and stand by my opinion, ESPN needs to focus on covering sports. I get that there are times when social issues pop up and can't be avoided, such as Kaepernick, Tebow, Michael Bennett, or the NBA players at the ESPYs. Reacting to those stories is warranted, but where the mistake gets made is when ESPN's talent abandon the world of sports and start the controversy rather than reacting to it. Jemele shared a critical opinion on an issue unrelated to sports which had no chance of a positive outcome. ESPN's own public editor, Jim Brady, called her out over it. The country is divided, ESPN is battling for every viewer and dollar, and by sticking to what they do best, they stand a better chance of succeeding.
I'm a First Amendment absolutist. I believe in only two things completely, the First Amendment and in booze.
I'm astonished at almost everything I just heard.
This is done. This is conversation over. Bye.
That was Clay Travis on CNN. And to channel my inner Allen Iverson for a second, we talking about boobs? Not ESPN, not Fox Sports Radio, boobs. Those who dislike Clay are going to bash him for acting like a male pig on national TV. Those who love Clay are going to question why people are so sensitive. What I thought was interesting is that whether he realized it or not, Travis actually bailed out ESPN because at the time, the company was drowning in negative attention. As soon as Clay became the story, the narrative shifted away from the worldwide leader for a few hours. I do applaud Clay for one thing, though. Exposing Keith Reed, who appeared to be a fraud. Reed appeared in the same segment and acted outraged by Clay's comments, yet the guy is on Twitter talking about Nicki Minaj's breasts, MILFs, and ass at the BET Awards. Now, you can take issue with Clay, but he's consistent in his approach. Unlike Mr. Reed, who played a part on television, which was quickly contradicted by his social media actions. If your only choice for watching NFL games each Sunday was through a streaming service, and that provider was having all sorts of technical problems, what would you do? That was the situation in Canada for opening week of the NFL season, as DAZN, D-A-Z-N, turned in a pathetic performance, leaving CEO James Rushton to apologize and promise improvements for week two. Things weren't as bad the second time around, but what's mind-boggling is that the company went through this exact situation 1 year earlier in Germany. They launched in August, a month before airing a big soccer match involving Manchester United, and then proceeded to have all sorts of issues when it came time to air their first big game. What happened to lead time? Testing other events? Anticipating and overcompensating for technical issues? And how did the NFL sit by without demanding a series of checks and balances be examined beforehand? This wasn't a case of one town being affected. It was an entire freaking country. Get your act together, DAZN, before Canadian football fans signal the end. There's a reason beyond the $50 million paycheck that the NFL likes Amazon. And as disruptive as it could be to TV, the radio industry should be paying close attention as well. Measuring the audience, their age, location, income, buying habits, and personal interests are important. But tracking purchases, measuring the effectiveness of an ad, and running commercials that are relevant to users watching specific games is outstanding. At a conference in Germany this week, Amazon said they plan to pursue more sports opportunities. If they can show clients specifics of their ad being consumed, leading to a purchase, the time it took to consume the message and lead to a sale, not to mention the simplicity available to users to watch games on the platform and shop at the same time or instruct Alexa to buy something, that's going to be powerful. And it's going to increase the demand of buyers to receive more advanced data from audio companies. I hope radio operators, more specifically Nielsen, are taking notice.
We learn the virtue of the huddle, where you take north and south, east and west, conservative and liberal, black and white, you give them the same color jersey, you give them a common goal, you let them sweat, tear up, and work hard together, and special things start to take place.
That voice you just heard is Sean Adams, who unexpectedly passed away this week at the age of 46 after an apparent heart attack. Sean's death has left family, friends, and colleagues hurting, but on Saturday, they were able to smile for a minute, thanks to a kind gesture from USC. You see, Adams was a big Texas Longhorns fan, and prior to Texas's game with the Trojans, a seat was left open in the press box, along with a note paying respect to the former radio host. Now, I didn't know Sean extremely well. I brought him to San Francisco for a few shows on 95.7 The Game, and we stayed in touch and talked numerous times over the years, but I found him to be a great human being. If we're to judge a person by the impression they leave on others, then Sean Adams is a five-tool player. He may no longer be with us, but while he was here, he brought joy to people's lives and he made those around him better. And that speaks volumes about the man he was. And there you have it, another rendition of the 5 and 5, or in this particular case, 5 and 6. Pass along your feedback on Twitter at SportsRadioPD or by email at jbarrett@sportsradiopd.com. That brings us to the interview portion of our episode, and this week I have the pleasure of speaking with iHeartMedia senior advisor and former CEO and president of CBS Radio, Dan Mason. He's one of the most respected broadcasters in our industry, likable, smart, and supportive, and since I launched BSM 2 years ago, I've gotten to know him better than I did during the previous decade when I was programming radio stations. Dan's experienced it all in management, and he's now pursuing his passion of calling games behind the microphone and camera. And with so much happening in the radio business right now, I thought it'd be helpful for members of the industry to hear his thoughts on a variety of subjects. So sit back, relax, and enjoy this week's in-depth discussion with Dan Mason.
3, 2, 1.
All right, Dan, when I talk to people about you, the first thing they identify with is Dan Mason, CBS Radio. So everyone knows what you've accomplished who's in this industry, but what they don't know is the road you've taken to get to that point. So I want to go back to the beginning. You're a Louisville native, graduated from Eastern Kentucky University. What were the early days of your career like?
Started in Louisville in the old WKLO and Wacky battles. I started at WKLO as an overnight disc jockey. Well, when you're an overnight disc jockey, you're doing the setup for the morning guy mostly. But and it was a fun time in Louisville. There were great disc jockeys that went through there. I used to run the streets with Coyote Calhoun at WAKY. He just retired recently from WAMZ there in Louisville, the big country station. But it was a ball. I had a lot of fun. But I knew I could do more. I wanted to be a program director. And I remember the program director at WKLO told me that I probably would not get up the overnight show. So I thought it was time to move on from there. And I was fortunate enough to get to go to what was then called Z93, which was a really popular music station in the Southeast, one of the biggest ones, and became program director at that station. From there, it was WPGC in Washington, D.C. as program director. But I did always have the ability to get ratings, which as a program director, which really helped project my career a lot faster on a fast track to get into management.
You knew at that point you wanted to be a program director. Most guys in their 20s don't even know what a program director typically does. So what was it that convinced you early on that this is the road you want to pursue? And how did you get to that level? Because as you know, in today's climate, you usually don't become a PD at the age of 25, 26.
Actually, I was programmed at 24. And I did that for a couple of years. And I said, wait a minute. I'm watching all these salespeople drive these nice cars, and my car is not so nice. So then I wanted to be a general manager. And at age 27, I believe it was, I became the general manager at KTSA and KTFM in San Antonio. So I probably at that particular genre of time, I was probably one of the youngest general managers in a top 50 market. And I did that for a couple of years, and then First Media, who owned WPGC and Z93, called me back to Houston. They had just bought what was then known as KFMK, which is now known as The Box, and hired me to be not only the general manager of that station, but I became the executive vice president of the company when we had Cube in Seattle, USN in Chicago, a station called Copa in Phoenix, and PGC and Z93, both, and KFMK in Houston. I did that for quite some time. Then, after that, I became the president of what was then Cook Inlet, who bought First Media. And from then, the company was sold to Infinity, and I, at that point, went to Westinghouse at Group W as the president of Group W. And then we merged with CBS, and I became president of CBS Radio, and did that, and then there were some internal changes after we merged with Infinity. But Mel and I did, we had a good five-year run together. But after Fareed left, John Sykes came, and it was probably a time in my life where I wanted to take a break, you know. And I just went in and resigned and took a five-year hiatus, so to speak. But all along, I consulted CBS Radio and did an international business with Walt Sabo. But then in 2006, I began talking to Les Moonves again. And in 2007, I went back to CBS and did another eight-year run and retired in 2015.
That seems like your thing. 7-8 years as the top guy, and then I got to take a break, right?
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, at some point, you got to retire, you know?
Yeah.
So I don't think there's not going to be a three-peat, let me tell you that. So,
as I'm listening to you, you casually drop in. I was GM here, VP there, then became president, CEO came next, and clearly to be rising up the ranks like you were, you've got to be doing something right, possibly even unique, because as you know, Dan, most companies don't give the keys to the castle to the program director. They often look to sales executives, especially in our current state of the business. Having gone through that transition, what advice can you share for someone who's looking to take that step today from program director to GM or maybe even CEO?
If you have to bring something to the table. And I think what I brought to the table was the ability to get ratings on the radio. I knew what good radio sounded like, and I knew what bad radio sounded like. And good radio will get good ratings. And that was an attraction. And people knew that if they hired me, that I would be able to make good sound programming decisions to get ratings. And I think that was it. I used pretty much good judgment along the way, hired the right people along the way, and it worked. And it's more of making the right decisions at the right time, I guess.
If you look at the current landscape of radio, there aren't as many programmers who get that shot to become the vice president or GM of a building. Why do you think that is?
Well, Jason, there weren't very many back then either. The same situation existed back then. I mean, programming guys didn't get a shot either back then. Now, you just had to have an understanding. Luckily for me, the gentleman who owned KTSA and KTFM and the general manager who was exiting loved programming. And I got a shot that way. Had they had been diehard salespeople, they wouldn't have hired me. But I just got lucky, and they had an appreciation for programmers. So if you get in a situation where a company does appreciate programmers, and then you got a great shot. I mean, look at CBS Corporation. Les Moonves is a brilliant television programmer and understands TV. You know, if that were driven by some sales or accounting person, maybe not so much. At CBS Television and CBS Corporation is a product-driven company, no doubt about it. And Les is a shining example of that.
So as you started out, you were interested in programming. You said you understood how to get ratings. When you move into the other side of the business, yes, you still have, you're overall responsible for the ratings of the company, but you're also now responsible for budgets. You're responsible for sales, every aspect of the organization. What did you do early on in your career to prepare yourself for that, especially as now everybody's looking to you to lead the charge?
Well, you've got to make good decisions and hire the right people in the right jobs. And then let them, you have to continually be engaged in all aspects of the business, but yet be smart enough not to be so overbearing you don't let people do their work. I think the key as a CEO, especially in radio, is that you have to have the right market managers. If you put the wrong market managers in there, you'll get absolutely killed. Market managers who know what they're doing and who know how to take care of their people. And especially your inner core people, that 5, 6, 7, 8 people who are closest to you, you have to have total confidence in them. And you can't be switching horses all the time. My theory was that you pick those 5 or 6 people to be your key people, and you ride them all the way into the beach. You know, you don't make changes 18 months in because you don't like the way that things are going in that 18-month period. Once you get married to those people, you back them completely. And you don't hire those people until you know exactly who you want. But when you do, you don't make changes unless something would drastically have to happen bad for it to go bad. And we had that same core group of people pretty much for the whole 8 years I was there.
Yeah. And on that note, I mean, during this time, you build CBS Radio to the premier organization, especially when you look at it from a sports standpoint, which obviously is the focus of the direction that I go with the podcast here. But you guys built the premier sports organization. You guys had Howard Stern on in mornings. You had Imus in Market One, close to 200 radio stations. The company is thriving. Take me through, Dan, because this is something I'm always curious about, and I'm sure a lot of people that are on the ground floor are wondering about. What goes into a daily routine for a CEO?
You have to be very, very flexible to have a lot of problems come at you. Try to keep your door open. Try to be patient. You're not going to fix everything in 1 hour. I don't think there's anything in radio that I haven't seen. Every bad situation I think I've seen. But you can't get too high on your highs. You can't get too low on your lows. You can't overreact. You can't react, period. You have to respond and never react because you'll panic people. You have to take things in stride. You have to be willing to, you have to be relentless if you know something's wrong. You have to keep pushing and asking for more. You have to ask for the bar to go higher. And that's what, I mean, you can ask those who are closest to me that, my wife says to me all the time, gosh, you're so nice. I can't imagine how anything ever got done around you. And I said, well, you should just go talk to Chris or Michael Weiss or Scott Herman. Maybe they'll give you some insight, you know. Well, I would always push higher. You push and push and push. And And I know I drove Chris crazy on some days, like, Chris, did this get done today? Or when are we going to get that done? Or I go down the hall to Michael Weiss, who ran sales at that period of time, and I say, Michael, you know, this station in Atlanta's got a 10 share. We've got a 2 share in sales. What's the issue? And that would be back the next month, and the third month, and the fourth month. But it's just, you got to keep asking for more.
You mentioned Chris, and I want to really talk about him because you saw something early on in Chris Olivero. At that point, he hadn't done the traditional route. He didn't go through 5 markets as a PD, but you knew, because he had been in New York, that there was something special, and the guy's had a heck of a career overseeing CBS Radio's programming. So what was it that you saw in Chris? And for those inside the stations that don't see what goes into his job regularly, what can you add that would give them better insight into why he's exceptional at it?
Well, there was a joke on the floor that someday we'd all be working for Chris because there was so much confidence in him. But I tell you what, that there's 3 key points that I always thought about. Number one, he knows how to work with talent. He really not only recognizes talent, but likes talent. He really enjoys being around talent and working with talent. And number two, I would say he's got a tremendous feel for the audience. He can sit in the grandstands in Yankee Stadium in the worst seats and feel good about where he's at and be able to talk to the guy next to him. But then I guess the third most important thing about Chris is that he's never in an ivory tower. He doesn't look at himself above other people. He lifts people up, never tears people down. And even as bad as the conversations could be with those that he has to have those with, he always leaves people with an uplifting spirit. You know, that's the best thing about him. And he's going to go far. He's a rock star. He's just going to do very, very well in his career. And I just think he's got so much potential that's still untapped.
So having guys like that, obviously you mentioned before about the importance of having a great circle. And when you've got guys like Scott Herman and Chris Olivero combined with yourself, that's how you're able to handle the responsibilities day to day and also build a great company in the process. But as great as all of you guys may be, fires are going to come up and you can't always plan for a fire. But when it happens, you've got to deal with it. And so you get dealt with bye-bye Howard Stern, bye-bye Mad Dog Russo, Imus situation. When those situations come up, take me through what that morning is like.
You know, when we did have situations like that, it wasn't like we pulled all 8 of our inner circle into a room. We might take a portion of the people.
Mm-hmm.
As you might well know, we might take our chief general counsel, our VP of communications, somebody like Chris, and start from there and communicate back to CBS Corporation. But it was a radio issue. I mean, we had to handle it, whatever that might have been, and make sure we were all on the same page, and then carefully and methodically put together a game plan on how we were going to deal with it. But we'd have to communicate almost hourly because things would change so much over time. And there were some long nights. Sometimes things didn't work out the way we wanted it to, but we kept our heads straight and we stuck to our game plan, and we make a decision together. We win together, we lose together.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way it goes. No finger pointing. You know, it's interesting. I used to tease all of them that they were all like lions in a cage. You know, the lions would be roaring at each other sometimes, but at the end of the day, if the lions ever got into a fight, the next day they come back and everything was fine. There was no grudges. You get a lot of high-powered people around. They've all got opinions, and they're very good at what they do. But that's what you want. You want spirited people. You want people with opinions and talent. And you can't have a bunch of people who say yes all the time. You want people who are aggressive, that are hungry, that they want to win. They want to go out and kill every day. You know, they're very spirited and knowledgeable and good.
Do you think anybody could have been successful replacing Stern the way a Boomer and Carton were able to lift up WFAN after Imus?
I don't believe so. Now, that was in the middle of when I was leaving.
Yep.
And Howard was still there.
By the way, but you timed that perfectly to consult for them and not be the guy.
Oh, well, you know, I wouldn't blame that one on anybody. That was just Sirius came along, and then a new chapter was started. But my recommendation wouldn't have been, there is nobody to replace Howard. I would have gone back probably to local morning shows in each of the markets. Possibly you could have done maybe one show per two markets, but you can't expect one show to ever replace Howard Stern. That's insane. That's just like suicidal. I mean, there'll never be another one like Howard Stern.
So going through all those things, it definitely tests you. You gain a lot of experience of how to handle situations. And you look at the recent issue that's come up in sports circles in the last week has been ESPN with the Jemele Hill situation. And a lot of people, Dan, have been critical of ESPN because they've been inconsistent with some of the ways they've handled different personalities going off on social media and talking about things that have nothing to do with ESPN. If you were working with ESPN and advising them from a leadership standpoint of how to get out in front of these things and handle them so they don't have the negative attention that they had the last week, what would you tell them?
It appears to me they don't have a social media policy for their talent. It really does. If they did, why would a situation like that occur where somebody's got such a great job that they would violate it? It honestly looks to me like they don't have a social media policy for talent.
They'll tell you that they do. The problem is it's very loosely interpreted. You know, when you leave it to interpretation, everyone interprets things differently, and they're going to follow what they want to do. So then when it blows up, you're left with the mess on your hands.
That could have been why that Jemele was not reprimanded, too, because they couldn't do that because they for what? They don't have a policy. They don't have a strict enough guideline that it's not as clear and concise. I know that at CBS that it was really very strict about what you could and could not do. I saw an interview over the weekend that Michael Smirkanish had on CNN. He made the comment that if he would have said some of those things, that forget what side you were on, that's not the issue, but if you would have said anything on social media of that type, they would have thrown his butt out of there.
Mm-hmm.
He made that comment. So it's pretty concise what CNN has. What advice I would give, I would say get a clear policy on social media for talent. It'll help the talent, too.
So what happens, though, Dan, when it's one of your flagship personalities? She's on SportsCenter 6. That's a big show they rolled out. She's obviously a key personality that they're trying to build around. What do you do when it's one of your main people?
If we've got a policy in place and it gets violated, you have to react. And there's a whole laundry list of penalties, and they range from a ton of different severities. But you have to deal with it. You just can't do nothing. And I think that at CBS, we had a pretty good track record of dealing with those. But we had the policy to fall back on. If I didn't have a policy to fall back on or guidelines to fall back on, I think I would have been vulnerable. I don't know what I could have done. I wouldn't have much to point to.
You obviously have been a big proponent of sports for a long time. You know, as I mentioned, CBS rose to prominence in the format while you were the CEO and president of CBS. What was it about the format that you liked early on that convinced you that it could be expanded and become a national success story for the company?
Well, after the debacle of replacing all those morning shows, we had Free FM, which was that pretty much a failed male-oriented talk format. You know the history of that.
Mm-hmm.
It left us with a huge hole in the company that we had to fill it with something. And it was just such a big opportunity to begin to put local FM sports on the radio. The first one that we did was Detroit. And we had seen some research, and I won't go into it where we saw that, but we saw some research that Cleveland, Boston, and Detroit were just prime targets because of the enthusiasm of sports fans there. And we launched in all three of those markets. And gosh, the stations just took off like crazy. Cleveland was a little bit slower. I wasn't real pleased with the quality of the signal there, but Boston was just a massive home run. Cleveland's doing well now, by the way. But Detroit just shot out like a cannon. And we already had the Tigers on the AM, and we just flipped them over to FM, and we did a simulcast, and just, you know, XYT was just an amazing station. It just went right to the top. It still does great. It's very profitable. It does just wonderful. And then a lot of others followed, like Pittsburgh. You know, we put them on all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
And Houston, Dallas. And it was remarkable. I think it's one of the things probably one of the three most things I'm proud of.
So are there any markets that you didn't launch in that you wish you had?
San Francisco, probably. If you ever do one of these podcasts with Chris Olivero, you could tell you how many times I would be knocking on his door about San Francisco. But anyway.
One thing I want to talk to you about as it relates to the format, as you know, it's people-oriented, which means it becomes expensive. You and I go to these radio conferences. We hear about the challenge of radio getting a bigger share of its pie. And when you have an expensive format, being able to monetize it and be profitable is challenging. And yet, I mean, we see the engagement. We see the passion of fans. It's through the roof. What's the biggest challenge for the buying side of our business and being able to generate the revenue that a sports station deserves to get from these advertisers, because they don't always come rushing to the gates to put their money into radio?
I think the saddest thing that you'll see is a radio station, a sports station that does well with really decent ratings, but a sales app that is so weak they just cannot sell their way out of trouble. And that's what drives me crazy the most. And, you know, there's a lot of reasons for that. They turn over too much. The sales manager might not know exactly what to do. I mean, there was a period of time where we sent a lot of our sales managers into successful stations for a few days to try to learn ideas and promotions to take back home. It's a lot of hard work. It's a lot of educational process that goes into it. And the turnover just kills you. I mean, that's that way with radio all over. The best thing in the world is to find a program director in a sports station who is very sales-oriented, that knows how to put good quality sales promotions without compromising the sound of the station. Then you really take off with these sports stations. They really do well.
So let's say you've got a good PD, you've got a good sales staff. The other challenge to this is the buying community. I mean, we see a lot of agencies and even local business that are skittish on spending their money. If you're trying to convince a advertising agency that's decided we're only going to put 5% of our budget to your sports station and you're asking for 20, what can you do to convince them that it is a great buy?
If you've got a great radio station, a great sports station, you're going to have 25 to 54 men. That's all, and they're going to see that in the ratings. And they're going to see the turnout, too. I've always tried to push the stations to go take video of all their promotions that they do, because they pack the house when they do these promotions.
Mm-hmm.
And the videos don't lie. I mean, it's really exciting to see a great crowd of people show up for something. That's like spec spot selling, just a little bit different version. But if you're a good station, you're going to get ratings. And if you're going to get ratings, you're going to get bought. And then if you have a good sales staff behind that and a real passionate leader, then you just can't miss. Even in smaller markets, I mean, that aren't rated, if you've got a passionate staff that knows what they're doing on the sales side and a really good sales-oriented program director, I don't mean sales-oriented, that they have to compromise the sound of the station, one that knows how to program it, but yet doesn't let sales get in the way of his product or her product, then you're going to have a really good situation.
Mike Francesa mentioned, I was at the Talkers Conference last year, and Mike mentioned that the rating story should be 35-64 men, because that's everyone who has the money. Would that change the fortunes of sports stations gaining more dollars from advertisers, or cost them more?
Well, I think that would change the fortunes of a lot of formats, including the classic hits format. It would change sports. It would change adult contemporary. It would change a lot. I tried to fight for that a lot in the old Arbitron days before they became Nielsen. I would love to see the whole demo shift from 25-54 to 35-64, but I never got up that hill. Well, Mike's absolutely right. He's absolutely right.
Well, because people are living longer now. It's where the money is. I mean, most people, you know, 26, 27, haven't even bought a house, whereas the guy 35, 64 is the guy driving the car, buying the house, paying his kids' college fund. I mean, I understand why it makes sense, but as we both know, radio is such a, well, we've always done it this way, and that's why things don't necessarily change real fast, but there is a compelling argument to be made for that.
Well, there's a lot of research to back that up, that's where the money is right now.
Well, let's talk about one thing that you decided to do. You know, CBS had always been strong on the local front, but then that changed. You decided to go into the network space with the launch of the CBS Sports Network, CBS Sports Radio Network. What was it about the national space that intrigued you?
We had been successful launching all these local sports stations. And at the time, ESPN, of course, they had the big share. They had everything to themselves. And then Cumulus was sitting there, and we met with Lou Dickey. And they had a good share of local sports stations, too. And we thought that the combination of our sports stations and their sports stations would make a terrific network, and that's how the network got formed. And we came along with a CBS Sports Minute, which was really Chris's idea, and laid that in as our network minute as a way to satisfy, even though like a WFAM wasn't just going to become a CBS affiliation and 24/7, because we were going to continue to be local, that was a way to get a network minute into it, which was brilliant, I thought.
Mm-hmm.
So we kind of formed the two halves of the company, or not halves, but their sports stations and our sports stations kind of became the de facto CBS Sports Radio Network. And it worked out well, and, you know, they're still working.
So when you look at it now, we're almost 5 years into the existence of CBS Sports Radio Network. What would you say the network is doing strong, and where do you think the opportunity is still to grow?
I'm probably not the best person to answer that, in all fairness to them, because I've been gone, Jason, since 15. But I guess my answer would be the same one I had in 2015. You know, it would be great if we could get, or they could get, a New York, L.A., and Chicago affiliate.
That had to be challenging for you because you're the CEO. You want this thing to do well. But at the same time, you can't disrupt your local stations, which have, you know, great ratings. They're generating revenue. But at the same time, you don't want to be known as the brand that's only on in market 127 and 152. So how do you decide on those things of whether or not to push a show on a local market or not?
Well, I think we used a lot of weekend programming. I hear a lot of that still.
Mm-hmm.
Mike didn't even like the CBS Sports Minute.
I'm well aware.
So, yeah, I guess there's no right answer. You're walking a tightrope all the time. So it is a challenge. But we weren't just going to displace local programming in New York and in Chicago at the Score just because we had a concept of a network. We weren't going to do that.
Let's talk about the big story that's going on right now. Obviously, you've been in the shoes of David Field. You know what it's like to oversee a company and go through expansion. Entercom and CBS are in the process of trying to get to the finish line and become one company. But there are a lot of people on the, as I mentioned earlier, when we're talking about what a CEO does, there are a lot of people on the ground floor going, all right, what does this mean for me? Is this good for the business? How will this help me in the future? Why do you think this is a good move for the radio industry?
Well, I think it's a good move. It'll bring more tools to the table for Entercom and CBS Radio. The Entercom has some good sports stations. It'll bring more strength to the sports network. It should. And it'll bring there's some really good people on both sides of the company that combine their minds together that should work out good. And, you know, I've known David a long time. I've known Wheezy forever. And with Chris in the loop, I think it'll be fun to watch them. You know, I hope they do really, really well. I think I'll buy their stock. So I'm excited for it.
I'm sure you saw Jim Cramer on CNBC. He was pretty pumped up about it.
I did. It was refreshing to see all the positive comments about radio. Somebody told me this a long time ago, and it seems like it's always right. It's the cream always rises to the top. I mean, the good people always seem to do really, really well in these things. So the talented ones always find a way to keep on going.
When you're the CEO, I can't envision that you have like this private TV studio inside, you know, the CBS hallways where you're ducking in to work on your reps while you're running a company. But yet, when you leave CBS, you all of a sudden transition into doing play-by-play. You and I first started talking. You said, hey, I want you to take a look at what I do as a play-by-play guy. I thought, this has to be like 30 years old, this stuff, because he's been running a company. And then I got a handle of it, and I went, wow, this is actually really good. How did you, A, keep up your chops, and B, talk yourself into even getting an opportunity to do that when you hadn't been on the air calling games in a while?
This is a hilarious story. This is really funny. I had not done a game. That game, I think you saw me do. I haven't done a game in 40 years. So I didn't keep up anything. So just get that out there. I didn't keep up anything. Some of the guys, like myself and the president of CBS TV, Peter Dunn, we used to tease Sean McManus sometimes about, hey, Sean, let Dan do a game. Let Dan do a game. So Sean says, oh, okay. He's kind of just, shut up, Dan. Will you please go away and let me eat my steak here? Because we would do these interdivisional meetings that Les Moonves would have, and we just kid around. We travel together a lot because we had to go from New York to L.A. We'd all end up on the same flight. So finally, Sean said, so I announced my retirement, which is kind of another reason that I wanted to retire, too, is I wanted to start something new. I really wanted to evolve. I didn't want to retire. I wanted to evolve into something else. So I didn't have any demos. I mean, I did radio back in college and a little bit after, but nothing like I'm doing now. So I get Kyle Macy, who's a friend of mine, and we go to Eastern Kentucky, and we do a demo. We just do a game, you know, and then we took it back and cut it up, and I synced it to video. Now, this is where it gets really funny. So I wasn't talking to a director or anything. I did audio and synced it to the video of the game, and I gave it to CBS. And so they listened to it and said, okay, you're pretty good here. We'll give you a shot. First game was at East Carolina. I remember it was January the 2nd of 2016. Well, we're into November now, and I'm thinking, oh, my God, I have never talked to a director in my life, never talked to a producer in my life. What am I going to do? Now I almost have ulcers over this. I said, I can't call up CBS and ask them to train me. They're going to think I'm an idiot. So I ended up hiring a crew from the NHL and paid them a lot of money to work with me, to train me. So the month of December, I'm in New York training. I had a producer. I had a director. I had a camera guy. I had a graphics guy. I even had a lady who was my stand-in for the woman that was going to do my first game with me. And that's what I did for the month of December of 2015. So I had to learn crash course really, really fast. I don't, like I say, it almost gave me ulcers. But come January 2nd, at least I was ready to be out on my own a little bit.
This was not a local opportunity. You're doing this on a national television network.
Fortunately enough, they invited me back for a second season, and the next 3 weeks I'll be sweating it out if I'm going to be able to do a third season. So anyway.
What goes into calling a game? Take me through what a week of preparation's like for you leading up to a broadcast.
You try to find something about the team that nobody else will have. You try to look for tidbits and facts, factoids, and you end up going to practice, and you want to be different. You want to just get something out there that somebody will be interested in hearing. And I do strictly women's basketball, which is what I love. I love the product. I really enjoy the sport. You know, because it's all about beating UConn. Everybody wants to beat UConn. And I've met the most interesting people and coaches along the way. But you want to make the game interesting and find things about the team. You know, because sometimes, you know, you go to a January game at DePaul when the kids are on break, and you might have 500 people in the stands. So you find something to make it interesting. But that's really a challenge sometimes. But it can be really, really good and really fun. And in my style, too, I'm trying to, you know what I'm trying to do, Jason? I'm trying to bring a little bit of old school announcing into 2017. For instance, you know, Kaywood Leopard is one of my idols, you know, back the old Kentucky days, UK days. And he'll use terms like barn burner. You know, he'll use that term. And I've told you that story 100 times. And I remember I was at VCU watching a practice, and I used this on the broadcast the next night. I said, looking at VCU at practice is like looking into a strobe light. I like to use those kind of things on play-by-play because it's different. Nobody does that, and it's kind of different to do that. But I kind of try to combine old school with now to try to make it more colorful, make it a little bit different. Sometimes I get in a little trouble for doing that, but it's better than just the same old blandness all the time. Sometimes I guess you can put too much sugar into the mix, but I would rather err for that than sit there and just be the same old all the time. I really want to be different, and I want to be folksy, too, on the radio. I think that is so cool to be folksy and come off like that. I did a radio game for St. Francis of Pennsylvania versus Mount St. Mary's, and I never will forget the open I did was, hello and good afternoon to the good people of Pennsylvania. It was really, really cool. It's really fun to do that kind of stuff, you know.
When you left CBS Radio and you started to pursue doing play-by-play, I mean, you were just trying to prove to yourself at that point, hey, can I do this? And then you find out, yes, you can do this. So now, having done it, is this something you have a passion about doing more of?
Yeah, I'd love to. CBS has a limited number of women's games. I'd love to be doing it at Fox. I know Fox has a lot. I tried to get on ESPN, didn't make it. But and also I did the Kentucky Derby last year for Westwood and NBC Sports Radio. I was an analyst there. That was a blast. That was really a lot of fun. And for the Horse Racing Radio Network, I do things for too. So that's a sport that I know very, very well. And I just would rather at this point in my life be behind the mic or in front of a TV camera than behind the desk. Let's put it that way.
You brought up the Kentucky Derby and working with the Horse Racing Network, and that is another area that you've gone into besides calling women's games on TV. What goes into that?
Well, I'm a horse owner myself. I have racehorses. I own them. I own four. But you take the Kentucky Derby, for example, that's a week-long ordeal. You get up and you go out, you go to the barn areas, you're back there watching the horses train every morning, and you're up at 6 o'clock, 6:30 in the morning. So you know a little bit about each horse in the race. There's a story about every horse that they have. And you watch the way they, you know, what when they run off in the morning, you know who's good, who's bad, and, you know, sometimes they misbehave. Yeah, so you've got a good angle going in on kind of what's going to happen. You know the group of four or five that are going to be there in the beginning. You know the group at the four or five that are going to be charging from the back. And horse racing really comes down to pacing, like at what time are they going to run. At the half of the race, is it going to be, you know, if the half gets run in 47 seconds or faster, that one group is going to show up. If it's 47 seconds or slower at the half, then another group's going to show up. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's more about the seconds and the fractions of the seconds with that. But it's a lot of fun. I really do enjoy it. And, you know, I think I'm pretty decent at it.
Well, Dan, I wrap up with a thing that I do on each podcast called Quick Hits. I'm going to hit you with that in a minute. But I've got to put one thing to you before we get to that, because it's something I've been thinking about. As we were talking earlier about the merger, right, and we see Entercom made a really bold move, and I liked it a lot. They hired Mike D., who's been a CEO for the Padres. He's been with the Marlins. He's been with the Red Sox. And I thought, wow, that's really interesting. They're bringing a guy from the sports world into radio. When you're at the table talking about the potential of how to make a partnership stronger, who better to have on your side for helping a radio company than the guy who's been on the other side of the table? Which then brings me to my point. Why don't teams do the same exact thing? That seems to make a ton of sense, no?
The opportunity that the teams miss is when you have a good radio sales staff, they become too stingy with things like for opening pitches, national anthem brought to you by. They try to hold too much back on their inventory. If they begin to share more with the radio stations, the good radio stations that really know what they're doing, I'm not saying that every radio station in the U.S. knows what they're doing on how to sell inventory. Mm-hmm. I mean, beyond CBS or beyond iHeart, forget the company's label. I will make a pretty clear bet that the team's sales staff are not as good as the radio station's sales staff. I think the radio sales staff are better. But if they would be more collaborative with the radio stations, I think they would make more money that way rather than hold back too much of their inventory. You know, it takes a person like a Mike D. He probably sees this already anyway, or somebody like myself or some other person who knows sports to be able to encourage him to loosen up a little bit and try not to hold on to everything, because I don't think it could be they're not the inventory that they're selling is they might not even be near sellout. I'll go one further, possibly tap the creativity of the Chris Oliveros of the world or the local people, maybe the Mark Chernoffs of the world or people like that inside the radio station to come up with different things and different angles that they've never seen before mm-hmm. beyond first pitch. So it's there. They just haven't thought of it yet.
So let's wrap up on this. I've got four quick questions I'm going to hit you with. It's a series I call Quick Hits. The first thought that pops to your mind to each of these questions, okay?
I hope I can do it right.
Dan Mason's favorite radio station to listen to is?
I listen a lot to WJFK in Washington, D.C. I listen a lot to WMAL in Washington, D.C.
The likelihood of WFAN having two new drive time shows in January 18 is blank.
Zero.
The play-by-play announcer who's done it better than anyone in Dan Mason's estimation is who?
Kay Wood Leopard.
And the one move you'd like to have back from your time as a CEO, which one is it?
Changing WNEW to a talk station.
My friend, this has been a lot of fun. I enjoyed the conversation. You've had a heck of a career. Appreciate the insight today and wish you well. We'll catch up again soon at another radio conference, I'm sure.
All right. Thank you, Jason, for the opportunity.
This is the Barrett Sports Media Podcast.
That was radio executive Dan Mason. If you want to follow him on Twitter, his handle is at Dan Mason Sports. There were a number of takeaways from that conversation. First, when he talked about the transition from programming to the GMVP chair and how it takes a little bit of luck and working with people who value programming, I thought that was interesting. When he talked about succeeding Howard Stern on terrestrial radio was basically an impossible task for anyone who would have stepped in afterwards, I think most of the people in our business today would agree. David Lee Roth just happened to be the guinea pig in that experiment. When he talked about the merger, he said he thought it would be good for the industry and gave you a little bit of insight into some of the qualities that Chris Olivero brings to the table, which if you're inside CBS, you already know. But if you're working for Entercom or another group, now you've got some insight into how he operates. I appreciated Dan's feedback on the importance of having strong market managers and getting sports franchises to loosen the reins and work with their radio partners to open the floodgates and earn more revenue. That would seem to make a lot of sense, but it's amazing how difficult some teams can be to work with. And finally, his story on how he prepared for his first opportunity on the CBS Sports Television Network after not having called a game for decades, I thought that was especially entertaining. I mean, clearly, he must have the gift of gab to be able to talk his way into that job. But then the fact that he took the extra steps that he did, hiring a crew to make sure he was ready, kudos to him for going the extra yard. But that brings us to the conclusion of today's episode. One thing I mentioned during my chat with Dan, if you work in the radio business and you have a free minute, check out Jim Cramer's evaluation of the CBS-Entercom merger. The video should still be up on CNBC.com. It's probably on YouTube as well. I thought his analysis of the deal and reasons to be optimistic about the future of radio was tremendous. I highly encourage you to check it out. Unrelated to that, a reminder that my main role is to serve as an advocate for the sports radio format and help companies, stations, and individuals as a sports radio consultant and strategist. I've been fortunate to work with 8 great clients and 6 outstanding companies, but I'm always looking to expand my reach and help others. If you're interested in a future evaluation and discussing how I can help your business, my services and contact information are available on my website, sportsradiopd.com. In the words of Kid Rock, if it sounds good, you'll hear it. If it looks good, you'll see it. If it's marketed right, you'll buy it. But if it's real, you'll feel it. So be authentic in everything you do. Until next time, I'm Jason Barrett. Thanks for stopping by.
I'd say that was a pretty successful broadcast.
Thank you for listening to the Barrett Sports Media Podcast. To stay updated on the latest sports media news, follow Jason on Twitter at SportsRadioPD and visit our website, sportsradiopd.com.